All right. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for listening to the Georgia Prison News weekly radio show. I want to thank everyone for listening all over the state of Georgia or wherever you may be listening to us from this morning. Like to just thank you all again, and hopefully you guys are having a good Saturday morning, and just hoping that something we'll say this morning or will help you learn everything and inform you on what's going on in our prison system. So at this time, we're going to bring Susan Burns in and start our show with, and I'm trying to work my board here, so give me a brief second and we'll work out the kinks. I'm trying to bring my Susan in at this time. All right, Susan, are you with me?
I am.
How are you this morning?
I am great. I'm sitting here looking out at how pretty everything is, and I'm looking forward to getting outside a little bit today. I love spring.
Yeah, it's beautiful out this morning. Before we get started, I just wanted to dedicate this show this morning to our latest victim in the COVID-19 pandemic that died this past week. That died this week in the Department of Corrections. I think it was, and refresh my memory, Susan, I think it was, what, Wednesday, Thursday?
In there someplace.
Yeah.
I
think it was maybe on Thursday. And then also to, I want to dedicate it to Mr. Aldrich Kane, who passed away last Saturday in a stabbing at Telfair State Prison. So show's going out to them this morning. And we'll keep their families in our prayers, in our thoughts and prayers moving forward. But I wanted to open the show this morning with some news that I learned on yesterday evening on the Georgia Department of Corrections actually starting back their transfers next week. And I'm paraphrasing, trying to get to my notes. They'll be starting back transfers on next Tuesday and Thursday, transferring offenders all over the state of Georgia. And I spoke with someone who works within the department at a certain agency. And this is the note that I want to share with our listeners this morning. Because I asked her, I said, well, how do you feel about transfers being widely open? And just to let our listeners know, Department of Corrections has continued to transfer offenders. They've been doing it pretty secretly, I may say, putting people on vans throughout this COVID-19. They've been putting people on vans and shipping them to other facilities since probably the last month and a half. But I come and they're going to start back with the Greyhound or the Bluebird buses, and it's going to be wide open. So I actually asked this person, I said, well, how do you feel about the transfers? And I'm going to quote her, and her response was, we are all unhappy. Even the officers, we have zero cases, but we feel that that will change after next week. The offenders are also on edge. That's what we are facing. You have institutions right now that's not listed on the Georgia Department of Corrections daily log that comes out with the confirmed cases. But I believe after next week and the weeks to come, you're going to start seeing facilities that doesn't have any case any cases start to get cases, because you're opening the floodgates, as you can say, with these transfers that's going to be coming in all over the state. So just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention, because I think that's a big deal. And I'll let you jump in here, Susan, also. But, you know, you're also getting you're also starting to see the first case at, I think, Baldwin has 18, but another staff person tested positive there over the weekend, over this week. And then you also had Hancock with his first case of an officer there. So you may start seeing numbers rise at Hancock, and you may start seeing the numbers continue to rise at Baldwin. Susan, I want to bring you in. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm like you. I am disturbed about this intention to begin transferring. To put it in perspective for everybody, Georgia Department of Corrections transfers around 500 a week. That was 500 per week when things are normal. And that's just the churn at Jackson alone, coming in from jails, going out to prison. That churn is around 500. What I would have loved to have seen instead of, we're going to start this on the 13th or whatever, what I would have loved to have seen is a strategy built into that, not just pulling a date out of the air, but perhaps saying we're going to go 7 days without any new cases before we begin to transfer, or even better, 14 days, the amount of time they were supposedly quarantining. How about 14 days with no new cases? That, I think, would give everyone, inmates and staff and family members alike, of they're putting some thought into this, how to minimize the transmission of this illness. It's very concerning to me. And if there is strategy in any of these decisions that have been made, it escapes me.
Right. And Susan, I wanted to challenge the listeners, and we have a caller also. I'll come to that caller here soon, but I want to make a point. So, and I want our listeners to just think about this and to kind of put some logic behind this. So, you have, and I don't know the numbers on how many is actually transferred per week within the Department of Corrections, but I mean, just look at it. Has the GDC put any thought process into these transfers taking place? I mean, and just to give the listeners a kind of a brief description on how this goes, the offender is called out about, I guess, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, or they're shackled and they're put on a bus with probably 30 to 40 other individuals are shackled and on this big bus, almost like a Greyhound bus, and they're on this bus for 3 to 4 hours sometimes as they transfer from a particular institution to Jackson State Prison. At this time, And these people are on this bus, like I say, there's 2 transfer days per week in the Department of Corrections. So my concern is, are they even going to take into the account, or they're going to sterilize and clean these buses after every transfer? Because, and Susan, as you know, there's so many cases that are so many offenders that hasn't even been tested and may not even know that they have this the virus, and they're just being threw on a bus and transferred to other institutions, and we don't even know if the Department of Corrections are going to sanitize and sterilize these buses after every week to you know, to keep down on the transmission to other people.
One of the initial procedures they put in place was to clean and sanitize the buses and vans after transport. But what we've seen as this has gone on, I think we're right at about 7 weeks now. But what we've seen is a lot of the things that the well-intended put in place have fallen by the wayside. For example, taking everybody's temperature on the way into the building, taking the temperatures daily of those people who are in quarantine for having been exposed. During this entire 7 week period, we have continued to hear about some transfers, you know, small numbers, probably on vans, but that 10 guys get transferred, they're put directly in the population, and then during the night, by the next day somebody's sick, they start pulling these people back out that have just transferred from somewhere else and have symptoms. So I think the exposure is pretty much done at that point, but it has continued, and I tell you what, I will send a note to Ms. Ammons and ask her what the plan is as these, you know, if there's a strategy, are they going to give everybody real masks, not masks made out of sheet, but two-ply masks and that sort of thing to wear while they're in transport?
Right, and I mean, you have to... And people have to understand that when you and you know, like I said, I'm trying to paint the picture as best I can, but you know, people need to understand that there when you're on this bus, I mean, it's tight. I mean, you can it's two to a seat, and there's not very much space to social distance on these buses or on the vans. So you know. You know, we need to know, are is it mandatory that they wear their mask? You know, what are they doing to try to sterilize buses after the fact? I mean, I can pretty much answer my own question, but I would kind of like to know that I'm almost positive that they're not going to do anything, probably not even a wipe down or anything like that. You know, but it would be it would be nice to put them on record as to what they're going to do to start for the sanitation part of things.
Well, let's make that happen. I will write to her and ask her the following. It didn't have a strategy in their timing. Are they going to require masks full-time for everybody on the vehicle? Will they be using hand sanitizer before they get onto the bus, which would be a good way to reduce the load of virus and bacteria by just sanitizing before they go in? And I know there's
right.
been reluctance among the prisons to allow the inmates to use alcohol-based hand sanitizers, but you don't have to get it in the bottle of Purell. They actually make them in, like, baby wipe size so you could wipe your hands with it, discard it as they're getting on the bus. I'd like to think those are some of the things they'd be doing, but let's see if we can nail this down a little better than nail a jello to the wall.
Right, because, like I said, you know, and getting back to the main point that I like to make, you know, it's just – I think it's irresponsible, you know, and a failure of leadership as a top, Susan. You know, the Georgia Department of Correction, they were already caught off guard, you know, at the beginning of this pandemic. You know, I asked you earlier, when did we first get word? And I think we got this actually started in the middle of March. And the Department of Corrections, they were not ready, even though it was out weeks and weeks in advance of what was coming. coming. They were not prepared. And now you see them going a step further of being irresponsible and actually starting to actually transfer offenders all across the state. I mean, you know, and I understand and I share the concern of people when they're concerned that, you know, we have zero cases at this facility, and you're now going to start shipping people who have not even been tested to have this, and hasn't told anyone, or whatever the case may be. You're now going to start shipping them to other facilities, and to start spreading the virus to other offenders and staff at other institutions. It's just it's irresponsible. And it's a failure from the top down, which we knew this for weeks already.
Yeah. I think another thing that they probably should, don't mean they will, but should add into that, they know who they're transferring and where they're going. They don't pull it out of a hat. Why not go ahead and test those people who are going to be getting on the bus? Go ahead and test them, so that we don't transfer people who are going to be sick next Tuesday. I think we could do this in a stepwise way that makes sense, and that everybody can agree that we're taking steps that are logical and preventative. I must be dreaming.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think we're probably both dreaming. But like I said, on this topic, I'd hope that they give us some answers on exactly what their plan is. I'm not counting on it. Not looking, you know. We can ask the question and you know, maybe get some type of answer. It probably won't be logical, but you know, we'll try to get some answer. All right, Susan, let's go over the numbers. This week.
Yesterday's numbers, total confirmed cases as of yesterday at 6 p.m., 88 staff, 273 offenders. And that 273 offenders is a little bit misleading, but it makes sense once you figure it out. But if you total up all the cases, starting with Atlanta, T.C., and going down to West Central ICF, that comes to 259 cases rather than 273. The additional 15 cases between 259 and 273 are the ones that are at the county and private facilities. So the 273 does add up, but it wasn't obvious at all how they got that number. A particular concern, though, with yesterday's numbers, we had a couple of facilities that had pretty big bumps. Calhoun had 12 cases. They had 8 and they went to 20. They were at 8 on Thursday. They went to 20 on Friday. But SAT had 4 additional cases, bringing them up to 22. Well, there's only 350 offenders at that facility, 380 offenders. So that's a 25%.
And you see a bump also at these probation detention centers and these centers. I don't know exactly what you call them, but you see bumps at these centers. And like you said, it's troubling, Susan, because you know, they only have 300 and something people. Is that right?
That's correct. So that's about 7 or 6.
Right. I want to bring in this time, Susan, because we have a caller and they've been holding for a second. So we'll kind of jump back in just a second. But caller, are you on the phone with us? All right, there's a 1157 caller. I have them online with us, but they may not be here. They make Susan, you can hear me all right, right?
Yes, I can.
All right, so caller, are you with us? Last four of the number is 1157. Hello. All right, so there's no. I can't hear anything, Susan. So, I'll just put that one back on hold. But, yeah, continue, Susan, on the point you were making about the numbers.
We're starting to have a lot of people sick, not recovered. Oh, but it is sort of ironic. When you look at the recovered cases, it's a miracle. Inmates recover more than twice as quickly as staff. Huh, think about that. So as of yesterday, we've got 63 sick at Altree, 35 at Johnson. It does appear that Lee State at 10 has leveled off. Lee State has not had a new case in 5 or 6 days. So that is great news there. But what I heard at Altree, and I heard it from someone there, was that the number at Altree is not 63 sick, it's 133. And,
wow.
You know, we recall that the numbers they're giving us are the confirmed numbers. And my understanding as I talk to people around the state is they are only getting a test if they are burning with fever. They're people who have 99-degree fever that aren't getting tested. So that kind of explains why there'd be a discrepancy between 63 and 133. I tend to believe these larger numbers because over the last couple of weeks at various prisons, they have emptied entire dorms and put them into the gym sleeping on the floor. And in the case of Rutledge, there are two dorms on the floor in the gym, and I believe that's true at Phillips State Prison as well. I've seen a picture of it, and they have their mats directly on the floor, and they're made up, you know, with a sheet and blanket and everything, and they're probably 6 feet apart. But, you know, I'm an old lady. I sure would hate to be having to get up and down on the to the floor. There doesn't appear to be any place for them to sit. In addition to that, some of the gyms have no shower facilities, and that's a problem. On the subject of showers, we talked about it last week about the situation at Central and at Baldwin. The situation at Baldwin has been ongoing. It's been reported for 4 weeks. At Central, this is the second week where the intention is to put them in the hole, and they ran out of places to put them and then have them locked in the shower.
All right, Susan, so let me stop you here.
Okay.
And I want to use the sarcastic tone here as I try to get the point out here. And you mean to tell me that they have people, and I don't know if people's ever visited a prison or if any listeners has ever been on any tour of a prison. So let me get this straight. You have people at various facilities inside that's sleeping inside of gyms. And I kind of want people to use their brain now, because so you're telling me that inside of these gyms, which is normally separate from the living quarters and the housing quarters, that they have people in these gyms, and there is, like I said, the gym is normally just a big building that's built separately away from the housing units. Mm-hmm. So they have these people in these gyms, and there is supposedly no, there are showers in these gyms, because I've never seen one in these gyms. So how exactly are they showering?
I was told in one case there were 56 inmates, no showers and two toilets. In a gym.
So
this is not a picture.
So I mean, it's troubling. And then, Susan, let's stop there for a second, because I think I posted on Thursday night from a offender who is currently incarcerated at Ware State Prison. Ware State Prison, as our listeners may know, are on lockdown, and they were locked down 3 days and only received a shower on the third day. Now, I also like to remind our listeners, because this is very important. I saw a note from another young lady who has an incarcerated loved one at Ware State Prison, and she told me that they only took 5 people out of a dorm and let them shower. So I wonder if that 5 was the ones that was raising all the hell and actually they took out to let them shower. I mean, 5 people. Now, I don't remember the exact number that's in the cell house. I think it's like 50 maybe in the cell house. But you let 5 people out of 50 to take a shower?
As a state, our citizens should be ashamed of our state government, our state agencies. And, you know, I'm not too different from a lot of my friends. I never thought prison would touch me. But once you get touched by it, you find all this out. And I'm ashamed of how we treat people in this state in the name of the state of Georgia. To give them showers. One guy who's on a gym, he's on a gym floor, said that when he went to breakfast yesterday, they had no milk in the facility, and he said he's been in 22 years. First time in 22 years there hasn't been no milk. They had bran flakes. That was breakfast.
Wow.
So,
yeah, so I hope our citizens of Georgia are paying close attention, Susan, because like I said, it's a failure of leadership from the top, beginning with Governor Kemp, all the way down to Timothy Ward, and all of these little phonies that's associated at the top of the Department of Corrections. I mean, you know, it's a shame. I mean, I every time I think of it, it pisses me off. It's shameful, Susan, that they would treat these human beings like this. And like I said, you know, it's not like it's just this stuff is just coming from one person. But you hear story after story after story statewide of things that's going on. So I mean, at some point, you can possibly question it. With one complaint that you hear, but I mean, we're hearing hundreds and hundreds a day taking place at these facilities.
That is a fact. I scroll through I guess there's about 7 or 8 of our Facebook groups that have to do with corrections in Georgia. And I scroll through every day and try to pick up as many of those issues as I can, And then I can sort it by facility and see where we've got multiple people at a particular facility saying the same thing, or the same thing, the same situation exists at multiple facilities. And, you know, we've got so much going on. Macon, I believe, as of today, dorm E2 is on lockdown. That's for 2 weeks. Ware has a lockdown going on there, and yet they have very few reported cases, but apparently the situation on site is not reflected in the numbers.
Right, and I do want to give the, you know, as we talk, because I don't want anybody to say that, you know, slander or anything like that, so from my understanding and reason, and just to give them the benefit of the doubt on this particular subject, is that we understand, and this comes from a nurse that is at a facility. So, just to clear the water for anyone that's listening, that you know is pro GDOC or whatever. So we do understand that it is possibly about a 10 to 12 day period before they get the a confirmed test result back. So that could be possible why we haven't seen the numbers at Ware and at other facilities rise, because the numbers are pending for those cases to come back.
That Department of Corrections manufactured masks and distributed them about 2 weeks ago, two to three, and made out of the material that's used for making sheets, single ply. And I'm hearing people say that their masks they've worn them out. Yet, well, some facilities have said they've received a second mask. And this second one was a two-ply mask. Great. Good. But then when I asked the question, are the staff, the guards and the other staff members in masks full-time too? No. I'm pretty sure that the virus isn't coming in on a drone. It's pretty much the people that are out in the community are bringing it into the prison.
Because as we know, the GDC, crazy enough as they are making officers self-report. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. They're making these officers and staff members self-report instead of testing every single staff person. They're making it self-report. So if they don't report it, If they don't know they have it, or if they're feeling bad but is ignoring it for whatever reason, they can still come to work and infect everyone. And because, like I said, it's self-report. The GDC is not, testing these people to find out. Or it's not testing their staff to find out if they have this virus. And in the meantime, you see the numbers completely rising. I mean, the prisoners are not going anywhere. Like you said, it's not coming in on a drone. It's not coming in on a store truck. It's not coming in, you know, however they may be. It's coming in from the staff. And for whatever reason, the staff either don't know that they have it, or they just think that, you know, whatever it is, that they don't need to report it. And that's why we see the numbers continue to rise. Because, I mean, hell, you don't have, you know, you have no guidelines in place for them to even, it be mandatory, be a mandatory test out there.
You know, they said in the beginning, the Department of Corrections designed this form that they called an attestation form. And the form doesn't have a full number on it, which means it isn't connected to a SOP, but The attestation is a full 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. You put the person's name on there and the date. And they cross their heart and hope to die that they hadn't been exposed to COVID, and they go in. Supposedly, they were taking their temperatures at that point. My understanding is that that has gotten much better. If they were having right at the paper, 300 reams of paper just on that one form. A ream's 500, you know, 500 pages. I would pay so that I could go through 150,000 sheets of paper in order to find somebody's record on whether or not they had a fever. There was
right.
If you have done this and have it all in the same document.
Right. And Susan, I've heard of facilities that's at transitional centers, to be exact, that they don't even have a nurse taking temperatures and things like that. They have an officer, probably a sergeant or a lieutenant, that actually checks the temperatures as people come in and come out. And I've also heard incidents where some days they check temperatures, some days they don't check temperatures. Some days they document, they make that person fill out a paper and record their temperature. Some days they don't. We're at a point where it's a joke to the powers that be, and it's a joke to all of any type of. At this point, Susan, and I can only speak for myself, but I don't know what the plan is going forward for trying to stop the outbreak. I don't know what the at this point, I don't think there is a plan. I think that they've had a month and a half. I think you sent me the note this morning where reported at Lee on 325. The first death was reported at Lee on 325. So they've had a month,
yes,
almost a month and a half. So they've almost had a month and a half to get their act together and to come up with some type of plan and some type of solution to combat this, and they've done nothing really.
I had an interesting experience yesterday. I had submitted an ORA request. That's the Open Records Act request for the fumigant, the chemical they're using to fumigate. I wanted to know the name of it. I wanted to see a label from the package that it comes in, and the MSDS sheet, the material safety data sheet, and the EPA registration number. So the attorney at Legal Services said I would have the information yesterday, and she didn't send it to me, which didn't surprise me at all. That's kind of been how my experiences with them go. But coincidentally, an inmate got in touch with me and said that he had talked with one of the men, one of the guards who was doing the spraying, and he asked him, what the heck is that you're spraying with? And he was told it was ionized hydrogen peroxide. Well, I can't help myself, so I went to the internet and looked up ionized hydrogen peroxide, and it is a fumigant, sort of. It's like fumigant light. It does not penetrate well because it isn't a gas. It's droplets that are vaporized. And when you do that, you go into an open area and you spray this mist. The mist settles over time, and it condenses on the chairs and tables and so forth, but it doesn't go underneath anything. It just, gravity is what happens here. It gradually, droplets fall out of the air, and then they condense on the solid materials. Now, in ionizing the hydrogen peroxide, it gives it a negative charge, and the particles are attracted to things in the room that have positive charges, and it actually seeks out through the charge attraction, seeks out the positive charges. But there are other things in the room that are negatively charged, and it repels those. So that doesn't make it a very good decontaminant. It was described as smelling like a chemical and smelling kind of like a disinfectant. But they had been taking people out in the yard, spraying, and bringing them back in 15 minutes. The data I found yesterday says that they should be out of the area for 2 hours. It also
right,
says
well, and,
that,
and let me cut you off, and I'll let you continue, and because I have a question. So what do we know about if this chemical can just be sprayed? Is it supposed to be wiped? Does the area or the place supposed to be wiped down, or do we know anything about that?
Yes, you are asking the right question.
Before
it's sprayed, the area should be cleaned, and so cleaned of soil, and then sanitized, so wiped with a disinfectant, you know, that it has contact with, whether it's Lysol wipes or whatever, and then spray the spray. But the ionized hydrogen peroxide, because it's droplets suspended in the air, it doesn't penetrate any gap that's a half of a centimeter, which is about a quarter of an inch. Any gap that big, it won't even go in it. So if you think about the things people touch and handle all the time, the telephone receiver, the kiosks, their tablets. Also, they should be removing all the food from the room to do that. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I rather doubt everybody was told to cover up their ramen noodles or whatever.
Well,
but,
yeah, or they don't even have it anyway, because I've heard Tilly hasn't went to the store in 2 weeks. So, If they have it, I'm sure they did not tell them that. Sure, they went out of the spirit of the moment and told people to get ready for yard. They probably just called yard call and then they sent these people in to spray. So I'm gonna give our number out real quick. If you want to call in and speak to myself this morning or Susan, you can call in right now. The number is 516-387-1865, 516-387-1865. Speak with myself and Susan. You have a question, comment, concern this morning, feel free to give us a call. Susan, but, yeah, I wanted to continue on this for a second. We found out that information on what exactly it is that they're spraying or supposedly spraying. But we see that the numbers are continuing to rise in certain facilities or whatnot. And do we know if they've been to Autry and Johnson yet to spray?
I'd be too safe to at this point. I made a note yesterday. And I hadn't seen anything about spraying in a couple of days. Heck, I don't see it now. But I believe they've gotten everywhere. But on this, a good decontaminant. It's low cost, and you get what you pay for.
Right, and we know that they're not. We know that they're probably spending less money as possible on this chemical,
yeah.
And you know, it's not. We definitely know that they're not spending a bunch of money on it. Hell, I do know for a fact that, and I had someone tell me one time, and I actually was just a few months ago, Susan, and this might blow your mind, but do you know the Department of Corrections, the state of Georgia, spends millions of dollars a year on floor wax to wax the floors in these prisons and facilities? They spend millions of dollars on floor wax. Of all things,
where are they waxing the floor?
Well, Susan, in the dorms, most wardens, and most whatever those guys are, what are they called? The that's over the and I know it. I just can't. It's not coming to me. But the people that's over the wardens over a specific district. Who are those people?
The regional directors.
Regional directors. That's correct. So that's why I have you on with me every week, Susan, because if you weren't here, I would have been just had a brain fart. But yeah, so the regional directors and the visitors and whatnot, when they come to these facilities, these wardens and these regional directors and all this stuff, they actually have the offenders wax the floors. Inside of the dorms, inside of visitation area up front, and if, believe it or not, I've seen wardens come in, and I've heard of wardens coming in as well, and they'll lock the building down because the floor is not waxed. They take pride in making sure that their floors are waxed. Where I don't know. Why they take big pride in that, but they love for these floors to be waxed, and you know they'll cause a big uproar if these floors are not waxed. So I didn't know if you knew that or not, but yeah, they spend millions and millions. Yeah, they spend millions and millions a year on floor wax.
Wonder why they don't just put a coating on the floor.
Well, I had
and
guy,
stop.
Go ahead. No, and I had a guy tell me. I had a guy tell me one time. He was the one that was telling me. I think he's been with the corrections department for like maybe 13 or 14 years now. He started out as an officer, and he's maintenance. He works. He's a maintenance supervisor now, and he was actually telling me that it was a big waste of money that they're spending millions and millions of dollars on floor wax, but this was a few months ago when they cut a lot of the staff positions at these facilities to say that they were running out of money. And he was telling me that they were spending millions and millions of dollars a year on floor wax, but they were cutting positions at these facilities. So that's how I learned about it.
Yeah, my goodness. Joshua, could we talk about Central and Baldwin?
Absolutely. Go for it.
Well, we mentioned that there are inmates being housed in showers. And there, I heard a week ago at Baldwin that the inmate who had been in the whole 3 weeks for being sick, when he was released, was basically in tears. He'd been in prison 29 years and said that was the worst 21 days of his 29 years. They had no clothes if they had underwear when they went, they used their underwear for toilet paper because they weren't given any. They were given buckets, but in some cases, they don't have buckets. They may give them a plastic bag to use for a toilet. Or we heard this week that they were actually pooping on trays. They used that, you know, food would come and they'd use the tray for their toilet, shove it back out the door, and that the trays were not being sanitized. My heart is breaking. If even a part of that is true, and we heard the identical story at two big prisons, there's probably some element of truth here. If even part of it is true, we are treating people inhumanely. And that is direct violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Right. And Susan, I want to cut you off real quick here, and I'm going to let you continue. But if you know of anyone in these facilities that's in showers, or you believe that their Eighth Amendment is being violated, if you will, get in contact with me or get in contact with Susan, and she'll pass it along. But I actually have a paralegal. Her name is Jessica for the Human and Civil Rights Coalition of Georgia, and she's actually beginning the stages of documenting every case that we learn of a potential Eighth Amendment violation, and she's actually documenting this stuff, and she's putting it all together in a spreadsheet. So at some point we can try to offer some type of legal help with these individuals. But, you know, we need to get names, and we need to, you know, kind of, you know, document and begin to document, you know, all the violations that's going on, so we can, you know, kind of start trying to get to the bottom of it. You know, that part, Susan, as you're aware of, that's the hardest part of actually trying to document and trying to get names and trying to get everything, you know, in order for that. But I'd ask, and reach out, if you would reach out to myself or Susan and kind of give us a story so we can document, you know, on what's going on. Because I think, Susan, I mean, this is a big issue. You know, the Eighth Amendment of cruel and unusual punishment is definitely taking place. They're supposed to have showers, and you know, that goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, just a few minutes ago, that, you know, you have all these people and in these gyms with no showers. You have people that's not showering, that's on lockdown, that's not showering for 3 or 4 days. I mean, that's a clear violation of the Eighth Amendment. And you know, like I said, I want to stress, you know, if you know of anyone, if you have any stories, then please contact me and Susan. You know, so we can document this and hopefully, you know, get something done. But go ahead, Susan.
Well, on that subject, Joshua, one of the things that I did several months ago, I've developed these questionnaires on different subjects that fall under the Eighth Amendment. And the purpose is to make it easy and concise to report violations of the Eighth Amendment. There's a questionnaire on violence, one on extortion, one on contraband, one on medical problems, one on mental health problems. And if you answer the questions, it just walks you right through what you need to be able to tell to report it. And on the back side of it, it's got the directions on who to send the information to.
Right.
The Department of Justice Civil Rights Office Special Litigation System has two phone numbers that are manned 24 hours a day to take these calls.
Mm-hmm.
It is understanding, one of my friends called, and she said it was super easy. So, reporting a committed violation. If you report it to the Department of Justice, it's not going to go back on you here. It will not.
Right. So, like I said, we want to continue to put that out there. Where do you contact the Department of Justice? Please also notify them. Like I said, you can get in contact with Susan for that information if you want to go the route of contacting them. You know, it is a I have my concerns about that. But it's also, and it's also good, and well, not also, but it's also good to notify anyone that we can, you know, with the conditions that's going on in the Georgia prisons. It's good to make sure that we let make everyone aware that we can about the issues that's going on, because, like I said. At some point, you know, Susan, I think that it's evident that at some point someone or some agency is going to have to step in and do something, because I don't have any confidence that the officials in Georgia can do anything.
No. Everything that I write to the Department of Corrections, for example, to Ms. Ammons about conditions or asking about the plan for resuming visitation and transfers and so forth, I also blind copy the Southern Center for Human Rights as well as the ACLU. I don't have any visibility to what cases they're working on, but it's like they have cases in the works against the prison system. So, you know, if they can use that information, I'll pass it along to them.
Right. And I know, Susan, and backing up that point, just since last Saturday, when we posted, Human and Civil Rights Coalition of Georgia, when we posted the information on our contact information for if your loved one was or if you knew of any situations of violence at you know, Smith, Telfair, Waycross, Valdosta, all of the level 5 prisons, to, you know, to interact with us and try to correspond with us and try to, so we can document this information. I think the last I spoke with Jessica, I think we had like 10 inquiries of statements that had came in from loved ones and family members of those individuals at those facilities. So, you know, like I say, there's the process when you're and just going back to what you said with the ACLU and the Southern Center for Human Rights. I know when you, in the process of those processes, those cases can take a while to generate, because mm-hmm. you know, you have to go through and you have to basically, you know, see if there's even a violation there, or if it's just, you know, someone that's just not happy. I know, for instance, with the Southern Center for Human Rights, they actually send a questionnaire out. Originally, they send a questionnaire out, and they try to get as much information they can from the offender on, you know, what's going on. Once that questionnaire is sent back to the intake officer, they kind of generate to see if they can generate a claim at that point. So, you know, it's a long process as far as, you know, starting anything as far as these cases. But you know, I think that it's definitely needed, Susan, because, you know, like I say, you have tons and tons and tons of violations, and you've had them. You've had them a lot for a long time. But at this particular moment, you know, and current situation, you know, you have a lot that's still going on, and it's just growing by the day.
I think we're at a kind of a crisis in that we've got this pandemic, and now we've got vocal advocates speaking out about Eighth Amendment violations, and the pandemic, the reaction to that by the Department of Corrections absolutely falls under the Eighth Amendment. But I still, you know, other concerns to kind of related to this. I've heard from various prisons that their food quantities have been reduced, and they're using the small styrofoam containers instead of the larger ones for meals. The quantities are less. The nutritional value is less. And people are hungry. And in some cases, they stop having store. And what inmates have been told is that was to control the spread of the virus by trucks.
Right. BS.
Yeah, I believe that one.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Susan, at a point, there comes a time when, you know, I don't know. I just think that, you know, that they'll lie about anything, you know, and to stop store call when they know that the portions have been downsized, when they know, and like I say, you know, you can't say anything. Well, I mean, you can say something, but you know, store call is a privilege. So I understand that it's not a right. But when you have this, and the individuals, like I said, they know that their food has been downsized, and you're stopping store call. I mean, what point is that? And then, you know, that's just like going back and saying, well, we're going to stop visitation because people are bringing drugs into the facility. But once you stop that visitation and your drugs are still coming in, and there's only one person, there's only one group of people that's coming into that facility, and they're officers, and they're bringing the drugs in. I mean, so they just don't use common sense, and when they don't use common sense, especially with something like that, it makes me believe, and I mean, it's just my own opinion, but it makes me believe that they're purposely stopping this stuff from going on because they just don't. I mean, that's just how they are.
Yep. I was willing in the beginning of this to give them the benefit of the doubt, but I've long since passed that and decided pretty much that these are lying liars who lie. And, you know, in addition to having less store call, they've reduced the amount they can spend on store at some of the facilities.
Wow, yeah.
I think down to $30 from $60.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think it's 70 now, but,
yeah. $30, and it may not be at all facilities, but I've heard that at several.
Well, and I've heard that there was issues this week at Dooley. There was issues this week at GSP. There was issues this week and I'm thinking off the top of my brain, Dooley, GSP. Maybe Phillips, and actually at Macon State as well, with the store call issues. That's just the ones that I've actually heard about this week. You know, so I think one week they even just, well, not one week, this week they actually was running store call for, I want to say, Dooley, and then they just stopped and said they weren't running store call for the rest of the population. So, you know, I don't know.
I know we're running out of time, but there was one thing I wanted us to get to today, if we could. You know, our prison population in Georgia is 96% men, mm-hmm. and that's pretty much what it is around the country. We've got something kind of bad going on, it's a bad trend at Lee Arundel State Prison. To give you some background, Lee Arundel wasn't always a women's prison. It was originally, maybe not originally, but around the year 2000, it had youthful offenders, men, boys, as well as men there. And they had a something of a scandal around 2001 of sexual assault. I believe in 2001 they had 40 sexual assaults at Lee Arundel when it was a man's prison. Since the 1st of January of this year, 4 full months, there have been 3 arrests for sexual assault at Lee Arundel. And, of course, the victims are women. And in one case, the perpetrator is a woman. But in the other cases, they are people who are working, civilian workers in food service. Not protecting our female prisoners. You know, someone, a woman who had been in prison at Lee Arundel asked me, what do you think they do at Lee Arundel when they find used condoms? Well, I mean, one would think that a crime has been committed of someone taking advantage of someone in a position where they're in a position of power over somebody else if they take advantage of that. And that's against the law. And whether or not the circumstance was consensual, they may or may not make it against the law, but the fact that it's employees assaulting inmates and there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of uproar over it.
Right. Right, Susan, and how many cases? I think this is the third or fourth one this year so far.
Yes, this is the third one of this type of sexual cases.
Right.
There's actually a fourth of something else.
Right, and I read the article that you sent me where it was talking about something as far as I think on one incident or one particular occasion, an officer brought some alcohol and cigarettes and contraband into the facility. Is that right?
Yeah, one even brought body jewelry in. Yeah,
wow.
You got to keep the piercings up. So,
yeah, and I think this is this is something that we need to keep an eye on because, like I said, and Susan, for the life of me, I can't remember. When you were talking about Lee and Arundel used to be a men's facility back in the 90s, I actually had an uncle that worked there, and I for the life of me cannot remember what that place was called back in the 90s, early 2000s, because
Lee Arundel.
Yeah, but it was called something else, and I can't remember. I hear all kinds of stories from even back in the 90s and early 2000 of sexual assault at that place, and it's just a major stream of violence back there in the 90s and 2000s, because like you said, it was a place for juveniles and adult men, but I can't remember. There was a name for it that was said, but I'm having a brain fart.
Too much allergy medicine. We'll run that down. But whatever you call it, it is a violation of all sorts of ways of a sworn officer, but you know, the women often are complicit in it because of seeking favor. It's just a sad thing, you know. Thinking about a world where we've all seen CSI, where DNA testing is so prevalent, if only there were a DNA catalog of the employees, and when they should find that type of evidence, that ought to be pretty darn easy to identify who it is. And, you know, clearly a crime's been committed, but I don't think there'd be a lot of enthusiasm for pursuing that.
No, and you're right. You know, I think that, you know, the cases should be immediately identified. And I think in this case, this last case that I was reading, Susan, and correct me if I'm wrong, this guy was immediately fired, right?
He was, but the actual misconduct took place in 2019.
Right. And the lapse, and you know, not defending them, but the lapse could have been, it did take place in 2019, but in some cases you see the investigation will last for, you know, a considered amount of time before they actually bring charges. So
yeah.
I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if that's the case here, but you know, I think that's sometimes that's some the reason why it takes so long to do that. But and Susan, and my understanding is while we're on this thing of sexual assault, I had information about maybe 4 or 5 months ago of a sergeant, and this is probably breaking news. I don't know if it's breaking news, but there hasn't been too much talk about it. And Susan, we have about 16 minutes, so I'll get into this a little bit since we're supposed to be talking about sexual assault today. But there was a sergeant who used to be at Ware State Prison. At that time, she was a sergeant. She actually made lieutenant and was she transferred to Dooley State Prison. Well, about 3 months ago, she was arrested and escorted out and arrested in the parking lot. If you can believe it or not, normally, and you can go on the GDC website and actually pull up contraband arrest and things of that nature for officers or individuals that's been arrested for any type of contraband arrest. Well, the GDC had put nothing out about this lieutenant being, you know, escorted out and arrested in the parking lot. So my understanding, it was not a contraband issue. She was arrested for having sexual relations with an offender. Now, the Georgia Department of Corrections did not release this information to the public. They didn't say anything about it. And as I said, this happened, you know, months and months ago. So we don't always hear of the incident with sexual assault as we do with the contraband arrests that we hear about. You know, we can go on there and they have something every month. And I was looking at it last night. All of the contraband arrests that they've had, you know, this month and last month, late last month. But, you know, you don't see there's been no mention of the situation at Leon Airedale with this latest officer being arrested. So the Georgia Department of Corrections doesn't put out information when their officer or staff has been arrested and fired for sexual assault.
It's my observation that actually is a change in policy from when Mr. Dozier was the commissioner. Mr. Dozier did ensure that murders and suicides were reported in press releases, that officers who were arrested and escorted out, that they were in the there was a press release when that happened as well, and that has not been happening. Last year in 2019, there were 25 suicides. It was a record year in Georgia Department of Corrections. 25 suicides, but only 15 of those had press releases. That was unprecedented. That was absolutely a change in policy.
Right.
One might even go so far as to say they're less transparent than they might be. Yeah.
And I've been reporting and releasing, trying to release the photo and the information when someone passes away or gets killed or whatever the case may be. I've been trying to pass that information out to the public, and we've seen, and I don't think it's a coincidence that we've saw the Georgia Department of Corrections stop releasing offenders' deaths due to violence, and I think they've done it because they don't want to. I mean, they're already looking bad with the virus outbreak, and then you have people still getting killed as well. So I don't think it's a coincidence that the Department of Corrections altogether have stopped releasing information on when someone gets killed that's not COVID-19 related.
The last Department of Corrections on an inmate death under investigation was March 14th.
Right, so over a month and a half, going on 2 months.
Yeah.
And there's been deaths at Telfair. We know that there's been deaths at Telfair. We know there's been deaths at Smith State Prison. We know that there's been death. We know that there's been deaths at GSP. We know that there's been deaths at Augusta State Medical Prison. We know that there's been deaths. I mean, the list just goes on. And I'm trying to keep an account and get the information out there when someone does get killed. Because I think that's important, Susan. I think that, you know, this information needs to be relayed to the general public. And, you know, this, unfortunately, with the COVID-19, it's given the Georgia Department of Direct Corrections and a cover not to report this information to the general public.
Absolutely. I believe completely that it is intentional that it's not being reported, not an oversight, because they've reported deaths by suicide homicide, or by accident. They've always, or at least over the last 5 years, done press releases on each one of those. And that is simply no longer happening.
No, and like you said, it's no coincidence. It's not, I mean, like I said, they already look bad with the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. So, you know, they don't want to look even worse with the not being able to supervise these facilities. And not able to to combat the gang violence and the you know, just unnecessary things that we see with the that's taking place inside of the inside of the prison.
By shutting down the press releases for anything other than COVID, the Department of Corrections is doing an injustice to the inmates and to their families. These inmates, under these current circumstances, where COVID has been out there for, let's call it, 2 months, these places
right.
are a they're a pressure cooker under the best of situations. But when you've got people that are quarantined, they don't get showers, they're getting less food, at some point, we are likely to see some violence in response to these other stressors.
Well, I mean, Susan, and not cutting you off, but I mean, we begin to see that. I mean, you
yeah.
know, we've there this week there was incidents of violence that took place, and I can't remember now at what facility, but you know, we're starting to see an uptick of violence. At Augusta State Medical Prison. I mean, you know, we saw unnecessary violence last week to take place. So, you know, we've already saw that. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, you're just saying what I was saying. At some point with a pressure cooker, the cork pops off. You know, I'm very worried about it. I think there are lots of people in Georgia prisons who don't deal well with some of the stressors that most of us would just roll with it. They aren't going to roll with it. And
yeah.
you know, like when you were talking about what happens. Happen when they distribute next quarterly package.
Right. Well, Susan, I think we only got about 7 minutes. So, as I do every week, I want to go ahead and give you opportunities to, you know, tell everyone what you're working on. I know you had some big news this week with They Have No Voice becoming fully funded. So, I want to give you an opportunity just to take the floor and give us an update on anything that you want to.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. They Had No Voice started about a year ago, and we were just going to look at a couple of issues. But it turned out that we needed to look at all of these civil rights violations that fall under the Eighth Amendment, the civil rights of institutionalized persons. And that would be mental health institutions as well as prisons. So I'd known for months that we needed to be a nonprofit in order to cover some of the expenses of open records requests and printing charges and so forth. And a former inmate has helped with the design of the development of a budget for this process. And as of this past week, we are fully funded, ready to go in a matter of about a week or two. We will be an official 501c3 nonprofit.
And that's great. That's fantastic news, Susan. We you know, I've been praying that you become fully funded and that things work out for you. And God is good because He opened those doors through the campaign that you started. And you know, your organization is going to do good work, and I'm very excited, as you are, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Of getting funded, because that's a big deal.
It is. You know, I'm an old retired lady with a computer. that's all that's special here. And I just because I was interested, and I did have a dog in the race. My son was in prison, and so many things went right for him. He is an exception to what usually happens to people. And I wanted to do something about it. I think that I can, and I'm going to. My best opportunity is to take advantage of the protections that the Constitution gives us. It just makes me chuckle how much driven by civics. But it's, boy, what a good call. What a good call.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, and just not changing the subject, but just want to let a programming know and let everyone know tonight, I guess at 6 p.m., there is a Prison Talk Radio with, I guess it's her, Moshe. Is that right, Susan? I don't want to butcher her name. Moshe Show? Okay, so Mocha. Okay, so I'll be on the Mocha Show tonight at 6 p.m. I don't have a link on how to listen. I'll try to get one and provide it to everyone later on in the groups. But I'll be on her show tonight to talk some, I guess, to talk about what's going on in the Georgia prisons. So if everybody can, I'll provide a link later on and kind of tune into that show as well tonight at 6 p.m. and kind of, you know, see what happens there with that. But Susan, like I said, I'm glad that that you received your funding, and I'm glad that you know, everything is working out for Georgia Prison News, for They Have No Voice, for the Human and Civil Rights Coalition of Georgia, for all the advocacy groups, you know, in the state that's trying to you know, give those men and women that's incarcerated a voice to give them a voice and have someone speaking out for them out here is a big deal.
I think so too. I couldn't agree more. Joshua, thank you. All right. Again.
All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you.
No problem. And we'll hopefully speak with you next week on the show, and we'll do it again.
Perfect. Okay,
all right.
Sounds good.
All right.
All right.
Bye-bye. All right, so we want to thank Susan Burns for joining us again on this week's show. It will be archived, and you can go back and listen at a later date, or you can go back and listen later today. Thank you, everyone, for listening once again, and we'll speak with you again next week on the Georgia Prison News morning radio show, and we hope that you enjoyed it, that something was informative, that you heard something that was informative that may help you. If you have any questions, reach out to me, Georgia Prison News, or They Have No Voice, Susan Sparks Burns. We'll be glad to answer any of your questions, concerns, or comments. Until next week, thank you for listening again, and we'll talk to you then.